do not want the Uniparty representing them. But what you do want is a unified Republican Party that puts America first, and that's the representation you are going to get. God bless you all. I love you. Thank you.
Oh, good Lord. So we got at least two more years of that screeching mini?
Yep.
Great.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Nice.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for what will certainly be another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. Am I right, Desi Doyen?
Yes, and gosh, it seems like there's a lot going on today.
There
for
is
a
lot going on today. We've got a lot to get to, so let's get straight to it. I'm happy to report, at least so far today, that after congressional and some statewide primary elections on Tuesday in New York, Colorado, Utah, and South Carolina, which held a congressional primary runoff election, I have yet to come across or hear about any noteworthy voting or tabulation concerns from those contests.
That is good news.
At least not yet. Listeners to the show, of course, know that we frequently do not hear about such things until much later after Election Day. But for now, the lack of reported problems means I can get straight to a few of the actual reported results from some of the key races in those states on Tuesday. And as the corrupt Supreme Court's, U.S. Supreme Court's term comes to an end, in theory this week, but we'll see. We've got still more opinions out today for good or ill, and I think we've got a little of each of those today. But let me start with the noteworthy election results from Tuesday, beginning in the great state of New York, where George Latimer, a pro-Israel centrist and longtime local Democratic official, defeated incumbent U.S. Congressman Jamal Bowman, a member of the House's Progressive Squad, on Tuesday in a Democratic primary in suburban New York. The contest, believed to be the most expensive House primary ever, thanks to millions of dollars spent on the race by outside groups, most notably the American-Israeli Political Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, highlighted deep divisions over the war in Gaza inside the Democratic Party, even though AIPAC is largely funded by Republican-leaning donors. With Latimer's victory, one of the most liberal voices in Congress and one of the most outspoken critics of Israel, Jamal Bowman, who accused Israel of committing genocide in Gaza, where thousands of Palestinians have been killed in military strikes by Israel following an attack on Israel by Hamas last year, well, Latimer, who got into the race at the urging of Jewish leaders and had heavy financial backing from AIPAC. Well, he's a former state legislator who has served as Westchester County executive since 2018. So he's well known locally and apparently much beloved. Bowman had been seeking a third term representing a district in New York City's northern suburbs in what is a very diverse district. His defeat is being seen as a blow to the party's progressive wing and a potential cautionary tale for candidates trying to shape their messaging around the Israel-Hamas conflict, or so that is what AIPAC appears to have been aiming for. Some major progressive figures had supported Bowman, including Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders, while Latimer pulled in the endorsement of former presidential candidate and New York Senator Hillary Clinton. The loss of Jamal Bowman disrupted what has generally been a stable primary season for pretty much all congressional incumbents. Most current members have been able to repel primary challenges from within their party, though Virginia's far-right Republican Congressman Bob Good, as we have been reporting, is still in a tight contest with an even farther-right rival who is backed by Donald Trump in a race that is still too close to call and almost certainly headed for a recount in the weeks ahead. Bowman's defeat is the first one, I suppose, sort of officially, for an incumbent this year in the House. He was first elected in 2020 after running as a liberal insurgent against moderate Democrat Congressman Elliot Engel, a 16-term congressman who chaired a House committee on foreign affairs. So that was a surprising loss for Engel when that happened. The 48-year-old Bowman embraced the political outsider strategy this year, even though he's been serving for two terms. He depicted Latimer as a tool of Republican donors and pro-Israel groups. In fact, the AIPAC, the Political Action Committee for them, spent nearly $15 million on the primary against Bowman, filling airwaves and mailboxes with negative ads in an effort to unseat him. Bowman has accused the influential pro-Israel lobbying group of trying to buy the race, which arguably they did. That said, on Israel, both Bowman and Latimer support a two-state solution. They have also both condemned Hamas's October 7 attack on southern Israel that killed around 1,200 people. But Bowman was one of the few progressives who rejected a symbolic House resolution in support of Israel following the October 7 attack. And as noted, he went further than simply opposing hard-right Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and condemning Israeli attacks on civilians, as many Democrats have done without facing primary challenges, by describing what is going on in Israel as a genocide. Talking Point Memo's Josh Marshall, who covers Israeli politics and its relation to American politics very closely, in a preview of the race on Tuesday, a few days ago, when it looked like Bowman was, in fact, likely to lose, Josh noted, quote, "This isn't the first time a squad member has faced a primary, nor the first time it's been funded, at least in part, by a lot of pro-Israel money. The difference here and why Bowman is likely to lose," he said a few days ago, "is that Bowman's district is very different from those which most of the squad come from, and one that isn't really a fit for Bowman's politics, especially on Israel, and especially in the hyper-politically charged atmosphere of the last 8 months. Bowman has called the Israel-Hamas war a genocide, endorsed the boycott, divest, sanction, or BDS movement, frequently discusses Israel as a settler colonial state, now says he supports ending funding of the Iron Dome missile defense that has protected Israel from hundreds of incoming missiles. Set aside a moment Set aside for the moment, he writes, whether you agree with those positions or find them objectionable. They're just not positions that are all that popular or safe to run with if you represent a mostly suburban district right outside of New York City. He says this is a purely factual statement. J Street, which is sort of the anti-AIPAC, supporting peacemaking and two-state solutions, has proven an effective backstop or shield for numerous House Democrats who support Israel, but not its current governments, its governments over the last 15 years. But he managed to lose J Street's support because of his intemperate remarks since October 7. To put it simply, Josh writes on Capitol Hill, Bowman has played the part of a movement politician while representing a fairly normie, Democratic-leaning suburban district. That's a big disconnect in the making, and it's become more so over his two terms in office. Says Josh, it's not the flash flood of spending from pro-Israel groups that has Bowman on the ropes politically. That confuses cause and effect. The money is pouring in because he's made himself so vulnerable in his district and was likely to lose. Groups like AIPAC, he says, very much want Bowman out of Congress, but probably even more, they want to make an example of him. Even more cynically, they want credit for his defeat, which is probably highly likely, if not inevitable, even before that money started pouring in. Josh concludes that Bowman's built a reputation as one of the most provocative movement politicians in the Democratic caucus while representing a textbook normie Dem district. That was apparently the problem. At least it seems to have been, and Josh seems to have had that one right. As AP reported, during the campaign, the 70-year-old Latimer, who has more than three decades of political experience, often displayed his deep regional knowledge and connections to make the case that he would be an effective member of Congress. Latimer has said that's the sort of politics people expect from their elected officials rather than caustic fights between the far right and the far left, which was a clear dig at Bowman and one apparently that was effective. Latimer reportedly defeated Bowman by almost 20 points. The last time I checked those tallies. Latimer will be the prohibitive favorite to win the general election in November. The district, which includes parts of Westchester and a small piece of the Bronx, is still a very Democratic stronghold. Also on Tuesday, Democratic voters on Long Island picked former CNN anchor John Avlon. I didn't even know he was running. John Avlon was elected as the candidate who will challenge incumbent Republican Nick LaLota in a district that has been controlled by the GOP for a decade. So we'll see how Avlon does. I must say that I would not actually have pegged Avlon as a Democrat myself, based on his years of reporting and what I've seen from him on CNN and elsewhere.
Yes, but as I understand it, he's involved with the No Labels folks. So that's
there you go.
Probably where he gets that centrist vibe.
I would have pegged him sort of as a moderate Republican if I had to guess. Nonetheless, he defeated a retired chemistry professor in the Democratic primary in a district which has become a priority for Democrats as they try to flip suburban seats in New York as part of a strategy to win back the House majority this November. But winning that seat could be an uphill battle for Democrats this year after state lawmakers changed the borders of this particular district during redistricting to make it slightly more friendly to Republicans, that in order to improve their chances in other districts in the state. So that's New York for the moment. In Colorado, and if your ears are still bleeding from the top of the show there, hearing Lauren Boebert screech, my apologies for that. But she won Tuesday's Republican primary in a U.S. House race that she jumped into last year, surviving a scandal over a video of her at a Denver theater and accusations of carpetbagging in this new district after fleeing what would almost certainly have been a tough re-election bid in her current district. After Congresswoman Boebert nearly lost her seat back in November of 22. Many observers in both parties were writing her political obituary. She won, after all, that year over Democrat Adam Frisch by just 546 votes. Out of more than 327,000 votes that were cast in what was thought to be a right-leaning, if somewhat swingy, third congressional district in western Colorado, but where Boebert was believed to be a shoo-in back in 2022 until the voters had their say, the remarkably close race ended up proving otherwise, and Frisch was then flooded with money to have a second run at the seat in 2024. But rather than running in the same district, the far-right firebrand Boebert pounced on an opportunity for what she saw as a safer path to re-election in 2024 when Congressman Ken Buck announced his retirement. He's a fellow Colorado congressman. That allowed Boebert the chance to run in a more safely red 4th congressional district in eastern Colorado instead of the swingy 3rd district that she is currently representing, but she still faced a competitive primary with a bunch of folks running for Buck's open seat in that 4th district amid accusations against her of carpetbagging. She also had to grapple with a lingering controversy after she was kicked out of a theater last year when she was accused of vaping and, well, let's just say giving her date a hand during the show, which proved to add to the disturbance that she was causing there at Beetlejuice. All of that, along with Republican opposition to Boebert not centralizing around a single candidate. So there was a lot of people running. They couldn't agree. Republicans couldn't agree on anybody else other than Boebert. And that appears to have contributed to her pulling off a very easy win in that primary, beating off her nearest of five competitors by some 30 points, and likely ensuring now that she will continue to serve and screech in the House next term for the next 2 years from her new district, which, as noted, is a very Republican one. She will run in November nonetheless against Democrat Tricia Calvaries, who defeated two candidates on Tuesday, reportedly. After Democrats had nearly pulled off that shock upset 2 years ago when Adam Frisch fell short of defeating Boebert by just a few hundred votes, Frisch is now still running again as the Democratic nominee for Colorado's 3rd district, which Boebert skedaddled from, but this time he's running against a different candidate who appears to be far less controversial than Boebert in that district, hoping to get their preferred opponent to potentially make Frisch's election easier. Democrats actually waded into the GOP primary for the seat between an establishment-backed Republican attorney by the name of Jeff Hurd and the very Trumpy former state senator Ron Hanks, an election denier. Frisch's campaign and other Democrats saw Hanks as an easier opponent to beat, and they aired ads to prop him up or to attack Hurd for avoiding debates or certain policy positions. But that effort was apparently ultimately unsuccessful, with Hurd comfortably winning the nomination over Hanks and a few other candidates. So the more moderate, less embarrassing Hurd was the winner. That race is still in play for Frisch, however, to potentially win, but it's likely to be more difficult for Democrats now without an overtly Trumpy opponent in that district, which, according to election forecasters, still currently favors Republicans. Still, Frisch's near victory in 2022, which caught the national attention and showed donors that, yes, he had a path to flip that seat, that has helped him to raise over $13 million. It's one of the biggest House campaign chests in the nation, and it far overshadows Hurd's current $1 million, but I suspect that might change soon.
Seems likely.
Now that he's got the nomination, we will see. Despite Boebert's win, it was not a great night for Trump allies everywhere. Elsewhere in Colorado, for example, political consultant and talk radio host Jeff Crank defeated Colorado GOP chair Dave Williams, who was endorsed by Trump in the 5th District. Crank bested Williams after the latter faced condemnation from fellow Republicans over his leadership, including the use of party resources to boost his own campaign. Crank is seen as a more traditional Republican, less inclined toward invective and the party's hard right wing, though on Tuesday night after his victory, he posted to Twitter, quote, "We have a country to save from Joe Biden's open border crisis and the failure of the Democrats' economic policy." It sounds pretty Trumpy to me. Perhaps he may be what qualifies now for more traditionally Republican. But that sort of rhetoric that he uses there, of course, is no less propaganda and nonsense, frankly, than anything Lauren Boebert is running on. Whatever that might be, other than making our ears bleed. And Trump's endorsement also failed to do the trick on Tuesday night in Utah, where voters were asked to choose between a moderate, not insane Republican willing to challenge party hardliners like retiring U.S. Senator Mitt Romney was, or a Trumpier far-right Republican to fill Romney's seat. Well, Utah voters chose the more moderate, Romney-like Republican on Tuesday. U.S. Congressman John Curtis has apparently won the Utah GOP primary for Mitt Romney's open Senate seat, defeating an opponent endorsed by the disgraced former president and several others who also said that they supported Trump's agenda. The 64-year-old Curtis lost the official party nod, however, at the state GOP convention earlier this year. Yet he was able to run in the Republican primary after qualifying for the ballot by gathering signatures. In other words, had he received the vote at the GOP convention, he wouldn't have had to gather signatures. But
he did. And so it sounds like the voters rejected the person that the party decided that they
wanted
in the state.
The party activists did. Right. Yeah. That, and apparently that route has become more common for more Republicans who do better in primaries when the state's Republican electorate, rather than those more radical party activists, when the regular Republican electorate get their say. Curtis is now, having won the primary, he's highly favored to win this November over the Democratic nominee Carolyn Gleick, who ran uncontested in a state that has not elected a Democrat to the U.S. Senate since 1970. For those keeping score at home, by the way, that would be three-term Utah Senator Frank Moss in Utah, who lost to Republican Orrin Hatch after his third term. Hatch then went on to hold that seat for seven terms before retiring and being replaced by Mitt Romney, who served just one term before announcing his retirement. Curtis has been compared to Mitt Romney for pushing back against hardliners in his party, and you'll like this, Des, particularly on climate change.
Mm.
Well, I like-ish him already. Curtis, who is known in
Congress. He's slightly sane.
He's not insane, I guess. He's known in Congress as a Republican advocate for combating climate change. Wow. Perhaps he should be added to the endangered species list. He was nudged into the race by a super PAC funded in part by, yes, a conservative climate activist, a guy by the name of Jay Faison. He initially declined a Senate bid, but he reversed course after Faison's super PAC ran ads encouraging him to do so. But Curtis's past ensured he was never likely to receive Trump's backing. He, in fact, lambasted Trump after the January 6, 2021 insurrection. He criticized Trump's trade war with China and his foreign aid cuts. He also voted to certify the 2020 election results, I guess the greatest crime of them all. And his wife was a supporter of Nikki Haley's presidential bid. So, yeah, probably not going to pull much favor with Donald Trump. Nonetheless, he defeated Riverton Mayor Trent Staggs, who was little known statewide before Trump's endorsement gave him a boost. Yes, Trump endorsed some mayor that no one had heard of in order to defeat a guy who actually was not insane. But that endorsement from Trump was not enough to beat the more moderate Curtis in a state like Utah, a rare Republican stronghold that has only half-heartedly embraced Trump, despite their other, now very Trumpy, U.S. Senator Mike Lee. Curtis will be a heavy favorite this November as he faces Democrat Carolyn Gleick, a professional ski mountaineer and a climate activist. So at least we're going to get someone who, at least in theory, gives a damn about climate out of Utah into the U.S. Senate.
So there's that.
There's that. We'll take them where we can get them. And though, one more here before we get to a break. Trump is, you know, obviously the still the dominant force in his party's politics, but still more of his endorsed candidates failed on Tuesday, even, yes, in South Carolina, which held a primary runoff on Tuesday to determine the Republican nominee and likely eventual House member for the solidly red 3rd congressional district. Nurse practitioner Sherry Biggs narrowly bested by about 2 points the Trump-endorsed pastor Mark Burns for the nomination there. She will face Democrat Brian Best this November in that deep red South Carolina House district. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with some news, both good and bad, or goodish and baddish, from our corrupt U.S. Supreme Court. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's your Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, there are a number of key rulings still to come this term from our wildly corrupted, stolen, packed right-wing U.S. Supreme Court majority, including at least one more on abortion, which, if a decision said to have been posted in error to the court's website today for a few minutes, if that is any indication, there may be some good-ish news for women who need emergency medical care that could include abortion, even in Republican states where the procedure is fully banned. But since that decision was said to have been posted in error, we'll wait before offering too many details of what was posted there or where the court will ultimately fall. We're also still waiting at this hour for rulings to still to come concerning Donald Trump's legal fate in two separate cases. One case called Fisher, which could nullify 2 of the 4 felony charges that Trump is facing for obstructing an official proceeding in his federal criminal indictment in D.C. for his various failed efforts to steal the 2020 election. And the other case on related to that from the court is his appeal for presidential immunity, which he believes gives presidents complete and total criminal immunity from any and all crimes that they may carry out while serving in office. And while that argument is clearly ridiculous and was thoroughly rejected at all the lower courts, it was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, nonetheless, serving, if nothing else, no matter how it comes out, if nothing else, to almost certainly delay Donald Trump's trial for trying to steal the 2020 election until after the 2024 election. the continuing delay in releasing an opinion there is disturbing for that reason alone, especially as compared to the Supreme Court's quick action on issues where it benefited Trump to have a swift ruling, such as when Colorado Supreme Court had ruled last year that he was barred from the ballot, that Trump was barred from the ballot due to his clear violation of the U.S. Constitution's insurrectionist disqualification clause, which the Supreme Court subsequently twisted itself into a pretzel in order to completely nullify on behalf of Donald Trump to let him run on the ballot, no matter what the actual text of the Constitution says. And so there's those and some others. There's still, in fact, enough unreleased rulings that is believed some of them may not come until next week, beyond the term's usual end at the end of June. And of course, after we will be on vacation and unable to cover them, which
of course
may either be a good or a bad thing for either you or us. I'm not sure, depending on how you might choose to look at it. But on Wednesday morning, there were two rulings of note issued by the court, one seemingly terrible and one seemingly not terrible. We'll start with the seemingly terrible one in yet another decision by the Republican Supreme Court majority that appears to make it more difficult for law enforcement officials to prosecute corruption by public officials, federal prosecutors. Said James Snyder was heavily in debt and he was behind in paying his taxes when he became the mayor of Portage, Indiana, back in 2012. The city at the time needed new garbage trucks and the mayor, Mayor Snyder, took over the required public bidding process after taking office. He spoke regularly with two brothers who owned a local truck dealership that also had financial problems, and he designed the bidding process so that only their two new trucks would meet all of its standards. He also arranged to have the city buy an older truck that was on their lot, and 2 weeks after the contracts were final, the mayor went to see the two brothers and told them about his own financial troubles. They agreed then to write him a check. A personal check for $13,000 for undefined consulting services. An FBI investigation led to Snyder's indictment, his conviction, and a 21-month prison sentence. That all sounds fine to me. But now, the former mayor has argued that an after-the-fact gift should not be a crime. It's not a crime. It's a gratuity. It is not a bribe because it happened after the fact, the former mayor argued. But he lost that argument before a federal judge and before the U.S. Appeals Court in Chicago. The high court, the Supreme Court, nonetheless, agreed to hear his appeal anyway in Snyder versus United States because other appeals courts in Boston and New Orleans had limited the law in question to bribery only and not gratuities that were paid later. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, it doesn't make sense as far as a moral choice,
well,
but it makes sense as far as a legal choice.
But you
choice.
Understand what happened here.
Yeah.
This was after the Supreme Court in recent years has repeatedly limited the scope of public election laws and what public officials can and cannot be prosecuted for. Well, on Wednesday, then, the Supreme Court struck down Snyder's conviction by striking down the part of this federal anti-corruption law that makes it a crime for state and local officials to take gifts that are valued at more than $5,000 from a donor who had previously been awarded lucrative contracts or other government benefits thanks to the efforts of that official. So keep in mind, it was already legal under federal law for an official to take a gift as long as it was valued at no more than $5,000 after doing something for someone like rewarding them with a contract. So, you know, a $4,999 gift card given to this public official would have been perfectly legal But now, by a 6-3 vote, the justices on our Supreme Court overturned that guy's conviction, the former Indiana mayor, who had asked for and taken a $13,000 payment from the owners of that truck dealership after he had helped them to win a $1.1 million city contract. See how this works? In ruling for the former mayor, the justices drew a distinction between bribery, which requires proof of an illegal deal, a specific, direct, explicit quid pro quo. For example, if you give me that, I will give you this. It has to be that direct now in order for it to be called bribery under the Supreme Court's rulings over the last 5 or 10 years. So they drew a distinction between bribery, that's bribery, a quid pro quo, and a gratuity, a tip, if you will, that can be a gift or a reward for a past favor. As long as we haven't agreed to it in advance, we can give you money later just to say thanks. The court's Republican appointees, all of them, said the officials may be charged and prosecuted for bribery, but not for taking money for past favors if there was no proof of an illicit deal beforehand.
Like, say, maybe expensive trips or an RV that a donor might give to you
after you do some great ruling
for them if you're on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, there's a reason the Supreme Court is poo-pooing things that are clearly public corruption of public officials. Quote, the question in this case is whether the federal law also makes it a crime for state and local officials to accept gratuities, for example, gift cards, lunches, plaques, books, framed photos or the like that may be given as a token of appreciation after the official act. The answer is no, wrote Justice Brett Kavanaugh for the apparently pro-corruption Republican majority, 6-3, all six of them. Despite Kavanaugh's reference to token gifts like lunches and framed photos, the federal law was triggered only by payments of more than $5,000. So, you know, that'd be a very expensive lunch or framed photo. But the court's right-wing majority said the federal law in question was a bribery statute, not a gratuities law, and, quote, leaves it to state and local governments instead to regulate gratuities. Justice Selena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, Ketanji Brown Jackson all dissented, writing, quote, officials who use their public position for private gain threaten the integrity of our most important institutions. Justice Jackson said the mayor's absurd and atextual reading of the statute is one only today's court could love. The law, as written, quote, possesses no genuine threat to common gift giving, she said, but it, quote, clearly covers the kind of corrupt, albeit perhaps not quid pro quo, payment that the mayor solicited after steering the city contracts to the dealership. The ruling could have a broad impact, apparently. Some 20 million local and state officials are covered by the federal anti-corruption law, including officials at hospitals, universities that receive federal funds. But now they don't have to worry about, you know, at least getting a little gratuity, a little tip after they've done something corrupt.
You can engage in a little corruption as a treat.
The Justice Department lawyers told the court that for nearly 40 years, the anti-bribery law has been understood to prohibit payments to officials that, quote, rewarded them for having steered contracts to their donors, but apparently no more. Of course, today's court, to quote Justice Jackson, has many reasons, as Des notes as well, to dismiss these gratuities as less than criminal. I suspect, especially after the critiques of justices for accepting undisclosed gifts above and beyond lunches and framed pictures, you know, from wealthy people. For example, Justice Clarence Thomas, who took lavish vacations and private jet flights to the tune of millions of dollars paid for by Texas billionaire Harlan Crow and the corrupt Sam Alito, who enjoyed at least one expensive fishing trip to Alaska. aboard a private plane owned by Paul Singer, the Republican hedge fund billionaire. So that was one of the cases, the not goodish or whatever I called it, bad decisions from the court. But in somewhat more encouraging news from the court on Wednesday, you may recall one of the few claims that, Donald Trump has been has been trying to sort of hang his hat on, you know, regarding a stolen election in 2020. They couldn't find actually, you know, any evidence whatsoever of voting machines flipping votes or ballot boxes being stuffed or anything. But he has claimed that the federal government somehow forced social media companies to prevent the viral spread of false claims about Hunter Biden's laptop before the 2020 election as the real evidence that the election was stolen from him. Never mind that it was, you know, actually Donald Trump's government at the time. But it would later turn into claims by Republicans that the Biden administration was somehow coercing social media companies to unconstitutionally block right-wing tweets and Facebook posts, etc. Well, on Wednesday, even several of the court's right-wingers looked at this, and they said essentially that it was nonsense, or at least those making the claim had no evidence of anything unconstitutional that had occurred. The Supreme Court on Wednesday sided with the Biden administration in a dispute with Republican-led states over how far the government can go to combat controversial and, in fact, dangerously disinformative social media posts on topics including COVID-19 and election security, etc. By another 6-3 vote here, but with three of the court's Republicans joining all three of its liberal justices, the court threw out lower court rulings that had favored states like Louisiana, Missouri, and other parties in their claims that the officials in the Democratic administration had leaned on the social media platforms to unconstitutionally squelch so-called conservative points of view. They couldn't even sell that nonsense to this court, apparently. Writing for the court's majority, the Trump appointee, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, wrote that the states and other parties did not have the legal right or standing to sue here because they could not prove any harm whatsoever. Justice Sam Alito, Clarence Thomas, of course, and Neil Gorsuch all dissented in the matter. The case is among several before the court this term that affects social media companies in the context of free speech. Earlier this year, the court heard arguments over Republican passed laws in Florida and Texas and attempted to prohibit large those laws attempted to prohibit large social media companies from taking down any posts because of the views that they express. The case is, and mind you, these social media companies, they're private companies. They can take down whatever posts they want for whatever reason they want. And here was big government, states like Florida and Texas, big governments telling private companies what they can and cannot do. The cases over these state laws and the one that was decided Wednesday are variations on the same theme, complaints that these platforms are somehow censoring conservative viewpoints when, for example, the Biden administration or, by the way, the Trump administration advised social media companies about posts that they saw to be inaccurate and had the possibility of causing public harm. Those were advisories. They were not orders by the government to remove those posts. In any event, the states had argued that the White House communications staffers and the Surgeon General and the FBI and the U.S. Cybersecurity Agency are among those who applied, quote, unrelenting pressure, unquote, to coerce changes in online content on social media platforms. The justices appeared skeptical of those claims during arguments in March, and several worried that common interactions between government officials and the platforms could be affected by a ruling in the state's favor. The Biden administration underscored those concerns when it noted that the government would lose its ability to communicate with the social media companies about things, anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim posts that could lead to public harm, as well as on issues of national security and public health during a pandemic and election integrity and so forth. But really, a lot of the damage has been done, no matter what the Supreme Court decided here. Elon Musk took over Twitter. He got rid of the, you know, the safety divisions of that company, basically allowing anything at this point to be kept up, no matter how disinformative it is, no matter how dangerous it is. Nonetheless, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said the court reached the right outcome here because, quote, it helps ensure the Biden administration can continue our important work with technology companies to protect the safety and security of the American people after years of extreme and unfounded Republican attacks on public officials who engaged in critical work to keep Americans safe. But the justices did not weigh in on the actual substance of the state's claims above and beyond saying, yeah, we don't see any constitutional issues here that you were harmed by. So they didn't weigh in on the actual substance of the claims or even the administration's response to those claims in their decision on Wednesday. Barrett wrote, quote, "We begin and end with standing. At this stage, neither the individual nor the state plaintiffs have established standing to seek an injunction against any defendant. We therefore lack jurisdiction to reach the merits of the dispute." Now, Alito dissented to that.
Of course
Alito,
he did.
Thomas and Gorsuch, he wrote the dissent for the dissenters, saying that the states amply demonstrated their right to sue. Quote, "For months, high-ranking government officials placed unrelenting pressure on Facebook to suppress Americans' free speech."
Oh, please.
But some free speech advocates, while praising the result of what happened on Wednesday, they lamented the fact that the court actually provided little guidance. So still kind of the wild, wild west out there. For example, Alex Abdo, the litigation director of the Knight First Amendment Institute, said, quote, "The platforms are attractive targets for official pressure, and so it's crucial that the Supreme Court clarify the line between permissible attempts to persuade and impermissible attempts to coerce. This guidance," he said, "would have been especially valuable in the months leading up to the elections." So, in fact, they decided nothing, really, when it comes down to it. We could see more cases along these lines. Yeah.
But I will note there was a hilarious footnote in there that the Supreme Court said, for clarity, they're going to call them Facebook and Twitter. We don't have to call them X or Meta or any
Meta.
Of that. They just said, that's what we're doing.
Thank you. So it's officially Twitter now. As I describe it, the site still known as Twitter.
And everybody else calls it that.
Even the Supreme Court agrees with me. Even this Supreme Court. Despite the fact that many of the complaints by Republicans were about actions taken during the Trump presidency, which they don't like to point out because that's who was in office back in 2020, a panel of three judges on the far-right Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals had ruled that the Biden administration had probably brought unconstitutional pressure on those platforms. Wednesday's decision, however, becomes the sixth one this term alone in which the court threw out rulings by the frankly out of control far, far right wing Fifth Circuit Court, which is teeming with Trump, crazy right-wing Trump appointments as one of the nation's most far-right appeals court. Last week, for example, the court upheld a gun restriction that was aimed at protecting domestic violence victims that was overturned previously by a Fifth Circuit court panel. Earlier in June, the court unanimously ruled that the anti-abortion doctors who filed suit also lacked standing in that case to challenge the FDA's decision to allow access to the abortion drug mifepristone. So case after case has been tossed out from the right-wing Fifth Circuit Court. When you hear me refer to the far-right Fifth Circuit Court, that is why. But with that reasonable-ish ruling, the worst, I fear, is yet to come still from the court before this term is all said and done. Whether we'll be here to report on it or not next week, we'll find out. Finally, in far brighter news that I really want to try to fit in here today, we reported a week or two ago on the governor of Maryland, Wes Moore. He issued pardons for some 175,000 people who were charged under state laws over the years for the use or possession of marijuana, which is now fully legal in the state of Maryland. So it made sense that Moore pardoned all of these people. Well, last Friday, in response to that good news, in response to that pardon, HBO's Bill Maher had this to say about it.
Wes Moore, he's the governor of Maryland. Mass pardon of 175,000 marijuana convictions this week.
Yeah.
Biden could do it. It's kind of a pander, but, you know, if it works, and again, the marijuana thing, that's not a pander, even though it would work that way. It's just good common sense and politics. I don't know why he doesn't do things like that.
Yeah, I don't know why. What's wrong with that, Joe Biden? Why doesn't he do things like that? You know, there's an election coming up. Why doesn't he do something that, you know, the people want him to do? What? Huh? He did? What? In fact, yeah, Joe Biden did do exactly that. 2 years ago, he pardoned thousands of people who had been convicted of federal pot-related crimes over the years. He did that back in 2022. And when he did it, since most marijuana laws and convictions are at the state level, not at the federal level, he asked state governors to do the very same thing for those who were convicted under state laws, as Wes Moore finally did a week or two ago. But apparently Bill Maher had not heard about that, so he misled millions of viewers about it on Friday. So even though we reported on Biden's federal pot pardons when they actually happened, as well as reporting on Wes Moore's in Maryland, I want to make sure that you at least hear about today's pardons by President Biden before Bill Maher ignores them and or misreports them sometime down the line in the future as if they never happened. Because Joe Biden and his administration continue doing long overdue good things for the American people, whether voters hear about them or not, whether Bill Maher hears about them or not, over the screaming nightmares of another Trump for president campaign. So this, as reported today by the military media outlet Task and Purpose, U.S. troops who were convicted under a now defunct military law that targeted gay service members will receive formal pardons, the White House announced on Wednesday. Can someone make sure to let Bill Maher know? Said President Biden in a statement, quote, "Today I am righting an historic wrong by using my clemency authority to pardon many former service members who were convicted simply for being themselves. Despite their courage and great sacrifice, thousands of LGBTQI plus service members were forced out of the military because of their sexual orientation or gender identity." The order, announced Wednesday, grants clemency to thousands of service members whose official military records reflect a conviction between 1951 and December of 2013 under the Uniform Code of Military Justices, Article 125. The UCMJ article had outlawed, quote, unnatural carnal copulation and, quote, consensual sodomy, language that was used for decades to prosecute gay military members. Such convictions or other punishments under Article 125 can bar members from benefits even after they left the military. That language was repealed back in 2013 after the Supreme Court declared that the prosecution of these cases was in fact unconstitutional. Biden's pardon will also apply to service members who have died. He said the pardon was about dignity, quote, dignity, decency, and ensuring the culture of our armed forces reflect the values that make us an exceptional nation. He noted that some service members faced court-martials over Article 125 charges and, quote, carried the burden of this great injustice for decades. So under the Biden administration, progress in this realm has continued. It has been a long time coming. The Pentagon has come a long way over the past, many decades. So and under the Biden administration, that progress has happily continued. Officials highlighted several policies and steps in recent years to protect LGBTQ plus service members in their interests, like lifting the ban on open service of transgender service members, defending attacks on access to gender-affirming health care, and implementing department-wide diversity inclusion policies explicitly for, quote, LGBTQI plus service members and civilian defense personnel. Officials said they'll, quote, continue to defend that work, even though, as noted, it continues to be politicized. Worse, it continues to be unknown what this administration, the actions, too many of the actions that this administration are doing. And yutzes like Bill Maher repeat them, or at least disinform the public by repeating false information, even 2 years after what you would have thought Bill Maher, of all people, would have known about, Joe Biden pardoning people for pot convictions at the federal level. But nope, he didn't. So now you know about that, and now you know about those as well. All
some
right?
Justice, finally.
Finally. Now, if only anybody in America knows about it, please let them know. We're doing our best here to let you know about it so you can do exactly that. I got to get out here. My thanks to our producer today, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download all of them anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible, no firewall, made possible by those of you who hit one of those donate buttons or stop by bradblog.com/donate to make a donation of any amount you can afford. Best yet, to become a monthly subscriber. bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site, still known as Twitter, says the Supreme Court. I am the Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.